Jobcast, July 2024 edition, Euclid Special, with Phoebe Ryder, Honor Harris, and Louisa Mason. Hello, and welcome to the Jobcast. I'm Phoebe, and joining me in the studio is Honor.
To celebrate the first images from the Euclid Space Telescope, we are doing a special Euclid episode. The aim of the European Space Agency's Euclid mission is to create a map of the large-scale structure of the universe by looking across more than a third of the sky and observing billions of galaxies out to 10 billion light-years away. This will allow us to explore how the universe has expanded and how structure has formed and shed light on the contribution of dark matter, dark energy, and gravity.
The telescope was launched on the 1st July last year from Cape Canaveral using a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and is currently orbiting around the Sun-Earth Lagrange point 2. Which is an average distance of 1.5 million kilometres beyond the Earth's orbit. This position means that it keeps pace with Earth as we orbit the Sun. And it has friends. Both Gaia and JWST are orbiting the same point.
Euclid has two instruments on board, the visible instrument and the near-infrared spectrometer and photometer. As the name suggests, the visible instrument collects visible light from wavelengths of 550 nanometres, which is green, to 900 nanometres, which is near-infrared. And has a resolution equivalent to almost 70 4K resolution screens. The near-infrared spectrometer and photometer makes spectroscopic measurements of galaxies, which means it is interested in how much light they emit at each wavelength. This is useful for determining redshift and distance to each galaxy. You might be thinking that this sounds very similar to the science goals of the James Webb Space Telescope, but the two missions do things a bit differently. Webb can observe extremely far back, and it really zooms into the details and gets up to the really high redshifts, whereas Euclid is intended to cover a much wider area of the sky and record data more than 100 times bigger than what Webb will be able to do. This is going to really help us to investigate dark energy, dark matter properly.
Also, you might be familiar with ESA's Planck mission, which made observations of the cosmic microwave background, and studying that has given us further evidence for the presence of dark matter and dark energy. And Euclid can build on this by helping us to answer questions about the nature of dark matter rather than whether or not it exists.
This month, Louisa talks to Chris Consolis about his involvement with Euclid as a lead legacy scientist for the ESA Euclid mission. Chris talks to us about his work looking for the earliest galaxies in the universe and how Euclid will complement the work of JWST so far.
Hi, I'm Louisa, and I'm in the studio today joined by Professor Chris Consolis.
Hi.
So this is a Jodrell Bank special, and you're one of our professors at Jodrell Bank, professor in extragalactic. So can you introduce yourself for the listeners? Tell us a little bit about what you work on and what you do.
I am a professor at the University of Manchester, and my main specialty is extragalactic astrophysics. So I look at how galaxies form, the properties of galaxies, and find ways of measuring properties of galaxies through cosmic time. And most of what I do is in the very early universe, looking at the very first galaxies and also stars and black holes, but also looking at how galaxies change from very early times to the galaxies we have today. So I try to find ways of understanding how the entire cosmic history, the universe, has evolved using galaxies as the tracer of that. So that's kind of a very quick summary of what I do.
Brilliant. So here at Jodrell Bank, you've got quite a large group working with the James Webb Space Telescope, but you're also involved in Euclid. For listeners that might not have seen the images and the data release, can you give us a little brief summary about what Euclid's about and why another telescope? What's special about this one?
Euclid is, in some ways, a complementary telescope to the James Webb Space Telescope, which for now is a better known and more famous telescope, but that could easily change quite quickly. The reason Euclid is different from the James Webb is that it has a very large field of view. So the field of view is several times larger, orders of magnitude larger, than what you can get with the James Webb Space Telescope. And instead of being a telescope that just points at certain objects like Webb does, what Euclid does is a whole survey of the sky covering about a third of the entire area of the sky. And that's an immense area. And the key thing about this area is that the imaging that we're going to get from Euclid has a resolution or a fidelity quality which is similar to the Hubble Space Telescope. So this is the first space telescope which is doing such a large area survey. And with Hubble, with James Webb, we get very, very small areas of the sky covered. But with Euclid, we'll cover 18,000 square degrees, which I said is a third of the whole sky. And already within the first few weeks of data being taken, we've already seen new things like new galaxies, new planets found, or at least free-floating planets or rogue planets, as some people call them. And that's just from basically 24 hours of data, which is the new public release that came out a few weeks ago. So Euclid, its distinct advantage is the large area and lots of things you can do by covering a large fraction of the sky, which you cannot do by just taking very small pictures of the sky like you get with James Webb.
So looking at the paper for Euclid, and we're seeing this more and more with telescope collaborations nowadays, the list of authors, it covers 3 pages. There's right. A lot of people involved in this telescope collaboration.
Yes.
And so there are lots of different fields of research and different
yes.
scientists that are all vying for this telescope time. How do you think that's going to play into how Euclid's going to be used?
So the main primary mission of Euclid is a cosmology mission. So that is the primary objective, is to measure the evolution of the dark energy. So we recently had some papers come out from the DESI survey, which showed that the dark energy might be evolving. And this is quite a big deal, because it means that we might actually understand the origin of the acceleration of the universe and why there is a dark energy. If we can see it changing, we can understand where it comes from and what is the physics behind it. So whilst DESI has done this, it's not done as well as what Euclid will be able to do, because Euclid is a much larger survey, much deeper in some ways. And so that's the goal, is to figure out how the dark energy is changing with time and then come up with models based on that. But at the same time, because you're getting such a large fraction of the sky to very deep depths at a very high resolution, you should be able to do lots of other science, because you're going to get galaxies, you need planets, star formation, galaxy clusters, the most distant galaxies in the universe. This will all be part of this data, because it's going to be both imaging and also, I haven't mentioned this yet, also spectroscopy in the near-infrared, which will be extremely valuable for many different studies. So just about anything you can imagine that can be studied in astronomy, let's say, any kind of objects, you'll be able to study some aspect of it with Euclid. And that's why there's over 1,000 people on that paper you mentioned, the overview paper for the whole mission. And that's why there are huge number of teams studying different aspects of the survey. So it's not just one team. Actually, it's a subset of many different teams who are working on different areas of the survey, and they all will look at a different aspect. So for me, for example, I look at galaxies, and I'm working closely with people working in the galaxies, but I'm also involved, at least peripherally, on other areas of what we call legacy science, which is anything which is not cosmology, and that will include these planet searches, looking at star formation, looking at nearby galaxies, distant galaxies. So there's plenty to do, and it should be very exciting. I look forward to seeing what we get for all these areas.
So you've mentioned already that you're not a cosmologist by trade. You work in extragalactic studies and research. For listeners at home, they might have seen news articles about the furthest galaxies that we see and the highest redshift. But what does that really tell us? What's your research involved in that? And what can that tell us about the universe?
Right. So we don't know when the first galaxies formed. There is a big time period in observational studies of the universe where we have no information whatsoever. So we can see the first atoms forming in a very early universe when we look at the cosmic background radiation, which was discovered in 1964 and has been studied in great detail. And it's a whole area of research, big area of cosmology. And that light comes from when the universe was about 300,000 years old. And then we can see very distant galaxies with Hubble and now James Webb back to when the universe was several hundreds of millions of years old. But between these two times, we have no information observationally whatsoever. We don't know how the first galaxies form. We don't know how the first stars form. We don't know how the first black holes form. We don't know how these things interacted together. And there's a lot of really cool astrophysics to be found once we can see these things. So James Webb, one of its main goals is to find this earliest epoch of star formation and galaxy formation. And so we're pushing further and further back in time with James Webb, and we now have galaxies all the way back to redshifts, confirmed galaxies all the way back to redshifts of 14, which is really very close to the epoch where we would like to explore, but not quite there yet. We have Canada galaxies, which are even further back, which can go back even another 100 million years before that. But we do not yet have evidence for the first stars or the first galaxies or the first black holes. So this is what we're really looking for. It'll take some time with James Webb, and Euclid will have a role on this too, because Euclid, because it's going to cover such a large area, will be able to find rarer objects. And rare objects in astronomy are usually the most massive objects. And so these things can tell us at where the first massive galaxies form with Euclid, whereas with James Webb, we're looking at more sort of typical average type galaxies, but they're much fainter. But with Euclid, we'll be able to find sort of these more rare kind of the really what would probably be the first sites of formation, because more massive things would have formed earlier, then Euclid will be able to find those. So combining those two telescopes will tell us a lot about how the very first things in the universe formed. But it will take some time before we get there, because we also have to do not only find them with imaging, and there's ways of doing that, by looking for galaxies that appear to be on the edge of the universe, at least from our perspective, and then we need to confirm them with spectroscopy, and James Webb can do that. Other telescopes can perhaps do it, but James Webb is the best to follow them up with. And once we have spectroscopy, we can understand properties of those galaxies and actually confirm at what distance they are, how young they are, what kind of stars they have in them, and etc. And that'll be the way that we'll find out when and how these first galaxies and stars form. So that's a big part of what I work on.
So you use spectroscopy for your extragalactic studies. Mm-hmm. What does that tell you about the galaxies?
So with spectroscopy, you're getting the detail of the lines, emission lines, or in some cases, absorption lines. So these are, think of a spectrum as like a black body curve, which is very smooth. But on top of that, you have lines of emission where you have different elements. So for example, if I wanted to find a galaxy which is the first generation galaxy, what I would look for is a galaxy which has a spectrum which doesn't have any emission from heavier elements that are formed in stars, like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. All of those elements are formed in star formation. So if you see those elements in a galaxy spectrum, you know it cannot be the first galaxy. It cannot be a baby galaxy, the first generation galaxy, whatever you want to call it, because it has these heavy elements that have had to form already in a generation of star formation before you're looking at that galaxy. So if you can see a galaxy which only has hydrogen gas and helium gas, and these are elements produced in the Big Bang, then you might be seeing some of the very first generations of galaxy formation, because none of the heavy elements have formed yet. As of now, we have not found a galaxy which only has helium and hydrogen. They all have these heavier elements for the most part. There's candidates that people debate about, but there's no smoking gun, so to speak, of a galaxy which is a primordial galaxy that doesn't have these heavier elements in it. So that's one way spectroscopy can help you. There's many others, but in terms of the search for the first objects, that is one really key way of using spectroscopy.
And so you're looking for the furthest afield galaxies to look earlier back in time, and you use these spectrums to determine how far away these galaxies are in terms of distance and time. How do the two relate? How can you use a spectrum to determine the distance to a galaxy?
Yes, so that's done by the redshift, and the redshift works because the universe is expanding, and so this goes back to Edwin Hubble and the Hubble law, whereas things which are further away are moving away at a faster rate, a faster recessional velocity, and so you can use that to determine distance. So at these very high cosmological distances, what we're seeing is really a rapid flow of galaxies expanding away. And so the further away the galaxy is, the faster it'll appear to be moving away. And so if you know what the spectrum is that you're looking at a galaxy, that is, you can identify, okay, this is carbon line, this is a nitrogen line, and you know the rest frame wavelength of those lines, and you can measure how shifted the lines are in the spectrum, how far to the red, then it's just a very simple formula to calculate what is the redshift, that is, what is the spectral shift of that galaxy, and then that gives you, just using very basic cosmology, how far away it is, etc., how luminous the galaxy is based on its light emission, and so on. So the redshift will tell you basically how early in time the galaxy is as well.
So I want to ask you a little bit about what life is like as a scientist in a collaboration like Euclid. The public data release has just been released. So what does life look like now? Do you attend meetings? Do you meet in groups? How does this actually affect what you do?
That depends a lot on your role in the Euclid collaboration. It's such a large collaboration that you can take on many different types of roles. So there's people working on the infrastructure, and that's basically all they do, which is really important because without the infrastructure, we wouldn't be able to do the survey at all. So people building software, people thinking about how to analyze the data once it comes down from the telescope, how to combine it with other data to come up with results. Then there's people who do the organization, organize the science. So I'm more on the organization of the science part, on the science coordination group of the survey. So I'm involved in the understanding and the putting together of how the collaboration works in terms of doing the science. And there are people who within what we call the science working groups, and the science working groups can be things like galaxies, galaxy evolution, nearby galaxies, distant galaxies, planets, so that all the science working groups, they all have a lead, and then people work in that group writing papers and so on. At least they will be writing papers once the data arrives in enough bulk for papers to be written. So it really depends on your role in the survey. It's so big now that you just, not everyone can do everything. Everybody does a very specific thing. So for me, as I said, I'm involved heavily in the organization of the project in terms of the science, at least, and what the science will come out of the project. And we have meetings. So next week is the general one-year meeting we have, which is in Rome. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to go, but I have to join online. But there are other smaller meetings throughout the year that people attend, and basically it's somewhat self-organized in terms of that. So different science working groups will have meetings that they'll organize, and people will go to those meetings. And usually it's around Europe, because Euclid is very much a European mission. There's some American participation in it. There's some Japanese as well, but it's mostly a European mission with France, Italy, the UK being the bigger partners, and Germany, Spain also, and there's other countries as well. But yeah, that's the basic way it works.
So what's next for you personally? You've obviously got the Euclid some data to work on. Have you got any other projects that you're working on, or where do you see your research going from here?
So my research for the next couple of years will mostly be on Euclid and James Webb. So trying to push that boundary in the distant universe further and further back, doing that with both telescopes. I'm also interested in looking at nearby galaxies, looking at the diffuse light in the outer parts of galaxies. This is something that Euclid will be able to study in great detail, but has not really been done very well yet, simply because we haven't had a good enough telescope to do it, but now Euclid will be able to do it really well. So that's another thing I'm quite interested in and have been working on with others the last few years as well. So that's really where I'll be working for the next couple of years, is finishing up that kind of analysis. And then hopefully after that, I'll be involved more with the Square Kilometer Array, which is being led to a big degree here at Manchester, and there's many colleagues here that work in that area. So I definitely hope to get more into doing more radio research to follow up how the universe is evolving, not only in the stars, but also in its gas, which is what SKA will be able to tell us about. One more thing I always like to mention in these kind of interviews these podcasts is that, you know, what we're doing is trying to understand the universe and trying to come up with a picture, both almost in a way historical picture of how things happened in the universe, how galaxy formation happened, which is in some sense what has happened, but that also can reveal the physics of what has happened. But also at the same time, what we're doing is we're learning about processes and about the scientific process of how we actually can infer what's going on in the universe based on our tools. And these tools are not only just a telescope, but also what we use for software to measure the galaxy properties, infer the other properties of galaxies that we can't directly measure, such as their stellar masses, their star formation rates. These are not directly measurable. They're inferred based on observables. But at the same time, it's all a scientific process, and these things can come together, and hopefully it'll tell us about what's going on in the universe. But as with all scientific projects, I'm sure what will happen is that at the end of the day, we're going to have more questions than we have answers. And that's a good thing. And then we can go on to the next big project.
Thank you. So thank you for coming to speak to us. And we're excited to see where it goes next.
Our Euclid theme continues with our Jodbyte from Jonathan Wong, a PhD student working on Euclid. Louisa and Honor speak to him about life, the universe, and everything to do with weak lensing.
Hello and welcome to July's Jodbyte. I'm Honor, I'm here with Louisa, and we're going to be interviewing Jonathan today.
Thank you very much for having me on today. So yeah, I'm Jonathan, I'm a PhD student here at the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics in Manchester. Most of my research is in cosmology, and I contribute to the Euclid mission. I've been in Manchester for 3 years now, so in the third year of my PhD, and before that I did my undergrad in physics and astronomy at Durham University.
Great. So to start off, how about you could tell us a bit about what cosmology is and what specifically you research?
Okay, so cosmology is all about asking the most fundamental questions in physics that are applicable on the larger scales of the universe. Right. So questions about what matter constituents there are in the universe, how gravity acts on large scales, how galaxies and the large-scale structure of galaxies that we see today have formed from the very initial seeds of the Big Bang, what the future of the universe is looking like, what we can learn about the universe by looking back over cosmic time. All of these questions are different things that cosmology tries to answer. The thing that I'm particularly interested in is something called the dark universe, or the dark sector of the universe, so dark matter and in particular dark energy.
$1 million question. What is dark matter and dark energy?
Yeah, so that is an absolutely fantastic question. And the very cheap answer that I can give you is that I don't think anybody in the world really knows what dark matter or dark energy is. But we know that they're incredibly interesting and they're incredibly fundamental in the universe. So at the moment, we think normal matter accounts for probably something like only 5% of everything that exists. And dark matter is this extra matter that tends to be associated with galaxies, and it tells us how galaxies form. That we can't normally see by using standard techniques, but we know has to be there by looking at things like dynamical motions of galaxies. And we think that accounts for something like 25% of the universe. Dark energy is something slightly different, which kind of exists everywhere in the universe, and particularly in between galaxies and in between all the large-scale structure that we understand is causing the acceleration of space-time and causing the universe to expand. And current estimates within the past 5-10 years say that dark energy could account for something like 70% of everything that exists. So combined, this dark sector, dark matter, dark energy, could be up to 95% of what makes up the universe. So hopefully you all agree that that's something that's really, really important to try and figure out and to learn about. And yeah, it's just really exciting to study.
That's really interesting. Thank you. So how do we actually detect this dark energy and dark matter?
Okay, so there's many ways of looking at dark matter and dark energy, using both simulations and observations of real data from telescopes. The one that I'm very interested in and most of my research is based on is a technique called weak gravitational lensing. Our listeners might be familiar with the term gravitational lensing in general. For anyone who maybe doesn't know, this is when the light that we observe from some astronomical source gets distorted by the presence of some foreground matter. And under general relativity, which is Einstein's theory of gravity, what we understand is happening is that this foreground matter is distorting space-time. So any light that comes from objects behind it that we observe gets distorted and tells us lots of interesting stuff about the foreground presence and also the background objects that we observe. And so weak lensing is, as the name suggests, the weak regime of this, where these distortion effects are in the light that we observe is really small. And what it results in is that any galaxy that we observe, its shape will very slightly be distorted by the presence of foreground matter.
So how can you use that to tell you things about this dark matter?
That's a really good question. The general answer is that it's incredibly difficult. Weak lensing causes a distortion to the shapes of galaxies, mm-hmm. but there are patterns to this distortion. So it means that if you have galaxies that are close together, their shapes are going to be correlated. Mm-hmm. And that correlation is really the signal that we're interested in measuring in weak lensing. And it's only something that we can isolate by averaging over multiple hundreds, thousands, millions, if not billions of galaxies. And certainly it's the goal of projects like Euclid, which I'm involved in, to sample over billions of galaxies. This signal that we're measuring by averaging over billions of galaxies, the reason it tells us about dark energy is that it tells us about the stuff that's in between us and the galaxies that we observe. Mm-hmm. So I said that the thing we're interested in weak lensing is galaxy shapes. And those shapes, the distortions to those shapes are caused by the presence of foreground structure. And that foreground structure is really what we're mapping when we measure weak lensing. The interesting property about dark energy is that it suppresses structure formation. So dark energy, because it's causing space-time to expand, it means that different objects and different structures in the universe can't form. So if we map out foreground structure by observing galaxy shapes using weak lensing, we have some handle on what dark energy is doing. Once we can map out the large-scale structure and the matter that's present in the universe by using weak lensing, we can start to understand how dark energy is affecting that structure formation, and then get a handle on what potentially dark energy is, what's causing it, where it comes from, what it's done in the past, and what it can do in the future.
That's a really fascinating technique for you to have told us about. So in terms of what's been done before and how this research has been carried out before, what sort of things could you tell us?
Yeah, so the weak lensing signal, this correlation in these galaxy shapes, was first kind of detected and first confirmed probably about 20 years ago now, so just at the turn of the 21st century. It was kind of first confirmed about 20 years ago. But as our observations have got better, and as we've been able to look at more galaxies and to look at objects and galaxies that are further back in time, you get basically a lot more statistical information about what dark energy is doing and what we can say about cosmology by using this technique. And Euclid in particular, the project that I'm working on, I mean, I think it's going to offer at least an order of magnitude greater precision than any previous survey has. And that will basically help us really narrow down what possible models of dark energy could be and to learn more about it.
Thank you for that explanation, Jonathan. So in case any of the listeners weren't already aware, Euclid has actually recently published the first science results. So how does this affect your PhD work and what work you've already done?
Yeah, so for all of us in the field and the consortium, it's been an incredibly exciting time. And the story and a lot of the images and the science results have been picked up by a lot of different news media agencies across Europe and across the world, and especially in this country as well. So it's something that we're incredibly happy about and incredibly proud about as a consortium, and also on a personal level to be seeing this interaction, this engagement. In terms of what I do, so I focus more on the weak lensing science, and what I've been focusing on is looking at simulation work. So I mentioned before that Euclid will sample over a billion different galaxies to try and isolate this weak lensing measurement, but that in itself is an incredibly difficult challenge and data science task. There's just so much data to crunch, so many numbers and so many statistics to derive from that, and understand how to computationally extract the optimum amount of information with which to do dark energy science. So what I've been looking at is simulating kind of the outputs and simulating the expected measurements that we might get and expected catalogues that we might get from Euclid, and looking at how to employ the best kind of analytical science techniques to extract this information on dark energy. So it's very much a kind of simulation and computational challenge as well as it is a scientific one.
So you're in your third year of your PhD. What's in store for the last of your PhD and possibly for the future?
Thanks for asking that. So my side, so for the next few months, I'm actually going to be away on a placement. So I'll actually be spending a few months away from JBCA, but when I come back, I'm actually really going to be excited to see where all of this work with Euclid goes. As we've already discussed, all these new science results are coming in, and it's really exciting to see now that it's getting to a more mature stage where we can start getting some really, really key science results. What I am interested in, and I think what a lot of the community is interested in, is actually then combining these measurements that Euclid has with other probes and with other telescopes that exist. So, for example, we have a lot of work in JBCA about the Simons Observatory, so it's using measurements of the cosmic microwave background, the relic radiation, which encodes information about the Big Bang and inflation in the early universe. And for example, the SKA, the Square Kilometre Array, which will map out large-scale structure in the radio regime. So cross-correlating these Euclid measurements with weak lensing with other probes and other data sets is a really, really powerful tool to further narrow down what we can learn about the universe.
Thank you so much for that, Jonathan. It'll be really exciting to see where Euclid goes and where your research goes.
Thank you very much for having me on. I very much enjoyed having this conversation.
And now on to some listener feedback. From Facebook, TK Aris says, I just wanted to let you guys know that if you ever decide to turn the word JODCAST into a terribly contrived astronomy acronym, I've made one up for you because I have too much time on my hands. The Jodrell Bank ongoing discussion covering astrophysical science topics. Brilliant. I like that.
Sounds really, really good.
Yeah, astronomy's full of acronyms.
Everything is an acronym. And then some feedback that we got via email from Frank Bailey in Shimonoseki, Japan, says, you're back. So happy to see one of my favourite podcasts is back in action. I've got some catching up to do. The Jodcast is a wonderful example of real science being presented effectively to the public. Is there a reason it's not on iTunes? That might help get more listeners.
Well, the Jodcast is on Apple Podcasts, which is iTunes' new way to distribute podcasts, so you can listen to us on there. We're also on Spotify, and we're looking into getting onto YouTube Music and other podcast platforms soon, so we'll keep you posted.
And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
Or via Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
Through Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can send us post, and the address is on our website. As we head into a new academic year here at Manchester, it would be great to hear what you like about the Jodcast and what you wish we did better.
Over the summer, the Jodcast will be busy reaching out to even more listeners. For students attending the National Astronomy Meeting at Hull in July, make sure to find our Jodcast poster and say hello to me, Phoebe and Mel. We have also published an article on our return in Popular Astronomy, a UK astronomy magazine from the Society of Popular Astronomy. Louisa describes what we've been up to in the background and what we hope for our podcast.
We will be taking a month away from the Jodcast, so there won't be an August episode. Our small team of PhD and Master students will be taking on conferences over the summer and passing their first year reviews, so we hope to tell you all about it in September.
Thanks to Chris Consolis for the interview and Jonathan Wong for our Jodbite.
The audio editors were Lily Correa Magnus, Louisa Mason, Honor Harris, George Bendo, and Phoebe Ryder.
The producers were Jesse Marin and George Bendo.
Until next time, Jod on.